Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, Aziz Ansari's new Netflix show, Master of None, finds him talking about show business, dating immigrant parents, and ribs versus chicken. We'll talk about how it's working and how it's different and how we like it. In our second segment, another very personal story, this time the YA novel Challenger Deep, which follows a teenage boy struggling with mental illness. We have done the reading, and now we'll do the talking. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Be honest, are you a music nerd or a fledgling music nerd who wants to know more about what's out there? The All Songs Considered podcast from NPR Music is here to help. All Songs Considered is a music discussion and discovery podcast from NPR. Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best new and upcoming music, including the Carrie Brownstein we never knew and a chat with Nico Case. Find lots of songs you'll fall in love with on All Songs Considered every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Netflix and novels are on tap this week, but before we get started, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. What do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us, fresh off her interview with Robert Galbraith, a.k.a. J.K. Rowling, is Barry Hardiman. Barry, when you are not interviewing some of the most famous authors in the world, what do you do here at NPR?
I dine out on that. No, I'm an editor at Weekend Edition.
Well, for those of you, if you have not yet heard that interview that Barry did, I do recommend it. It's really fun. Mm-hmm. You can find it in our podcast feed a couple episodes back. It's a good one.
Thank you, Linda.
We enjoyed it. And we're always happy to have Barry here. We will be calling on Barry's book expertise later in the show. But first, we have gotten a lot of requests to talk about Master of None. This is probably the most energetic reach outs that I've had in a while from people who are specifically want to hear us talk about something. The show was created by Aziz Ansari with Alan Yang, who was a writer on Parks and Recreation, which he was on, as many of you know. Ansari plays Dev, a struggling New York actor with a lot of New York sitcom problems. He is navigating his dating life. He's working on his career. He's still working out relationships with his family. The show also stars Noelle Wells as his love interest, whose name is Rachel, Eric Wareheim from Tim and Eric as his buddy Arnold, Lena Waithe as his buddy Denise, and a lot of other people, including Kelvin Yu, H. John Benjamin, Todd Barry, Claire Danes, and of course, Aziz Ansari's parents as Dev's parents.
His actual parents as his actual parents.
Exactly. I'm going to start with Barry, if I may. Barry, how did you respond to this this show? This is on Netflix. There are 10 episodes.
Right.
How did you react?
I responded by eating up all of my free time to watch all 10 episodes.
Nice.
Yes, absolutely. I don't know how you're not supposed to binge on it immediately. I found it so incredibly charming. It actually filled a hole that Parks and Rec had left, and it owes a lot to Parks and Rec.
Sure.
Paris Whittles. You know, I mean, there's
Whittles
a lot of people involved in it that are wonderful. But the whole of the show that is incredibly sweet and good-hearted, but then has this Netflix kind of raunchy, fun, much more sort of cutting edge than Parks and Rec was. And I think there is almost, I haven't watched a show, gosh, let me think and see if I think this is true. I haven't watched a show in a long time that I felt accurately portrayed a moment in the culture as far as particularly technology goes. And then on the other side, I think race goes.
Yeah. Right. I talked on this show about Aziz Ansari's book, Modern Romance, which came out earlier this year, where he collaborated with a sociologist to write a book. A lot of it is about dating and texting and dating and online dating and stuff like that. And there is a lot of, it's not based on that book, but there's a lot of shared material between this show and that book. So if you're interested in kind of what he's talking about, it's both reflected in that book and also in a lot of the stand-up that he's been doing for the last couple of years, which is what the book grew out of. So he's been kind of around these topics for quite a while. And I should mention, our friend Kat Chow, who many of you have heard on this show, is back from a stint in Texas working for a station there. and told me today that she's kind of interested in writing something about the show, maybe too, because it does get at this immigrant parent question. Mm-hmm, and sure. Had things fallen differently, it would have been great to have her here for this, but that's kind of how the scheduling shook out. There has been a bunch of stuff written about specifically the immigrant parent aspect, and I think we'll provide some links to some of those pieces because there have been some great pieces written about that as well, and I didn't want that to go unsaid. So, Stephen, how did you react to this show?
I really liked it. I do think that it has some flaws. Season-wide, like in terms of the overall arc of the show, there are plot lines that are kind of rushed in ways that I think could have been fleshed out slowly over the course of more seasons, where like all of a sudden it kind of rampages forward with the relationship in ways that you would expect a quieter show like this to take its time with. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that it's done is as in a 10 episode block, it still has some of the issues finding its footing that a weekly sitcom would have. Mm-hmm. I think the first episode is the weakest.
Oh, totally.
I think that in the first episode, there's a crisis where he thinks he may have gotten this love interest pregnant. And then there's this whole thing about, like, you know, what if I became a parent? What is it like being around kids? And I found some of those observations about parenting and kind of this big kid who hasn't grown up yet felt very familiar, felt very, very pad. And I was a little, I had the reaction watching the first episode, like, am I on board with this show? I'm not sure I'm on board with this show. The joke density is pretty low, particularly in that first episode. But it gets better and better. And each episode adds something unexpected and gets you somewhere that you don't necessarily see in all these shows. The second episode is the one that introduces not only his parents, who are his actual parents, but the parents of his buddy Brian. Mm-hmm. And you have the juxtaposition of like the kind of shallow, materialistic New York young people and the experiences of the parents that come into play and the personalities of the parents that get to come into play. You know, as it goes along, it's adding a layer until it hits this magnificent fourth episode on Indians in TV and where he is auditioning to be an actor on this, you know, very obvious looking TV show. And his
I will say the audition for the Law and Order, what is clearly a Law and Order-ish role as a cab driver is pretty spot on what that dialogue sounds like. Mm-hmm.
and it's bringing in all this commentary on issues of race and issues of culture and issues of generational differences. And as it is taking those things on, it's getting funnier and funnier. I think that's really interesting.
When it would take on stuff like that. I mean, that's just that stuff about the immigrant parents, the stuff about Indians on TV. We just haven't seen that on TV, which is kind of the point of the episode.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was anytime it's engaging that directly, I was in. I have vast reservoirs of good feeling for Aziz Ansari. I love his stand-up. I love him on Parks and Rec. This show depleted some of them,
kind
of shrank him a little bit. It is so overtly sweet and surprisingly sentimental.
Of course you'd have a problem with that.
And sincere
tooth.
That it has this tone, this feeling of a student film where the dialogue is thesis statement after thesis statement after thesis statement. And it just felt thin to me. And there was a piece in Slate a couple weeks back called Against Subtlety, The Case for Heavy-Handedness in Art. It's by Forrest Wickman. Of all the Slate pitches, this is the slatiest pitch to ever pitch a Slate. This is so classically contrarian in nature that it's not so much
everything you're doing is wrong.
It's not a Slate pitch. It's a Slate lob.
Right.
It's straight down the middle. And the point is basically, you know, why should an artist hide what they want to say? Well, isn't the point, shouldn't we just be reaching directly for the heartstrings? Shouldn't we be more direct? And I totally buy that if what we're dealing with is a great injustice. People like Orwell and Spike Lee and Larry Kramer during the AIDS crisis and Sinclair Lewis, they had something and they wanted something to say. And so they said it stridently and keenly. When the topic is the nuances, the emotional nuances of a human relationship, I want to do a little bit more work. I want to be in the mix as an observer. It reminded me a lot of the some of the critiques I had against Top Five, which, again, centrally, it's a comedian who is not necessarily an actor. So some of the limitations that Chris Rock brought to it, that stiffness, is kind of here. He spends so much of his time in this show trying to be likable. At the moment, any kind of selfish or negative aspect to his character arises, he sees it and throttles it down and diffuses it before it has a chance to land. So it's like Louis, because this does not have the tone of an antic sitcom. This is not a joke a minute, as you said, Stephen. This is nothing like 30 Rock or anything like that. This is more Louis without the bitterness, without the sourness, just with sweetness. And there's certainly a market for that, because I know a lot of people. Exactly. I know a lot of people just don't dig Louis because of that cringe factor. There is no cringe factor here, and I just felt like I needed something a little bit sharper.
I don't think it's entirely sweetness, though. It's sweetness cut with a lot of selfishness.
It's sweetness cut with a bit of selfishness. But again, as soon as anything comes up, he, as he's walking and monologuing with his friend, discuss how selfish they are, and then they spend the entire rest of the episode dealing with it. As I say, it feels like student film. It feels like this earnest thing is brought up, and then we talk about it in ways that nobody talks.
But I think it knows it's a fantasy. I mean, this is the thing. Like, even to the point of, like, this is such a new Friends in New York thing that, like, the apartment is gorgeous of this struggling actor. And, you know, so I feel like it knows that it's a fantasy. It almost feels like it's shot like a fantasy.
I don't buy that at all.
Really? So for me, that, like, those sorts of, I hear you, it is candy sweet. I was in the mood for candy sweet, so I watched 10 episodes of candy sweet, and I love that. It doesn't need, you know, and I love Louis too. I will also say, like, I'm in the market for both of those things. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that this would have worked for me as well if we got to the hard edge of Aziz Ansari's selfishness. Yeah. For me, you know.
I also want to defend a little bit the idea that it's unrealistic or fantasy-wise. Yes, of course, the apartments are ridiculously lovely compared to what you would actually necessarily see. There are some subtleties and some nuance and some cleverness in the casting where I feel like the people he's dating look like people he would be dating. You don't have that Woody Allen thing of like Woody Allen has to choose between Rachel McAdams and the French model.
Sure.
There's a certain amount of realism in the casting throughout the show. Like, these look like people you know. They look like people you hang out with when you hang out in New York. A lot of that felt very natural and in ways that I found appealing.
Can I defend the time jump from you now? Which, because I thought that the time jump in that one episode, which you wanted to see that, and I think in a perfect world on a network sitcom when you would have gone week to week to week to week, you would have seen it. I thought it was so clever to have seen them go through a year. I thought that was almost the only way you could do it if you were going to do it. That worked incredibly well for me as just a, what a nice way to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think, Glenn, when you say people don't talk like that, I think what you're saying is people don't talk so overtly about how they feel about identity and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't agree with you.
Okay,
let
me just say what actually I was saying. You can hear the writing. Because the actors may not be up to the material. I don't think that's true because there's an actress in one episode called Ladies and Gentlemen, Khadola Rashad, who just brings, she's on the screen very briefly. She makes that dialogue seem incredibly natural. Nobody else is doing that. That's what I mean.
I don't think it's unrealistic that people would be having these conversations. And I think that in my own experience, I do talk about feminism with other women quite a lot. And I talk pretty plainly about
there.
Yeah. I talk pretty plainly
I've sat quietly and nodded at those conversations.
About these are the frustrations that I have with something. And so that part of it, you know, having them kind of externalize those feelings about, for example, the guilt of dealing with their parents and things like that, and that feeling of like, am I a bad child because I haven't had the same struggles as my parents, that didn't bother me. The time jump essentially takes place within his romantic relationship. And I think it's not a time jump as much as it is an acceleration. And I think what they're trying to do is something that's fairly honest, which is to say, once you meet someone and you really like them, that first stretch of time is relatively uneventful in a certain way. And you only see the change in it in certain kind of aspects. And if you show those repeating aspects, you see the evolution of the relationship. It's a way of not making the stakes of the relationship that you're constantly going to break up, which isn't necessarily how it feels in the first 6 months to a year. And this all comes back to, like, look, I am a romantic comedy person, right? I get it. There is so little good romantic comedy on television, so little. The parts of this series that involve that relationship to me mm-hmm. are terrific romantic comedy.
Agreed.
Terrific romantic comedy. If I have a complaint, I mean, the nice thing that happens is sort of the first half of that show has more of the stuff with his parents. It has the Indians on TV episode. The back half of the show is more the relationship right. stuff. I enjoyed both halves, but for me, the catnip is that romantic mm-hmm. comedy part. Because for me, what this show is so good at is getting to the fact that he is looking and looking for something that feels authentic mm-hmm. in his dating experience. Mm. And what the show lands on is what is ultimately most authentic is how much you can love the company of another person, mm-hmm. including a new person. And the way that they experience this delightful mm-hmm. early relationship where they have so much fun together and they think the same things are funny, they think the same kinds of things are funny. Mm-hmm. You can see moments where somebody sort of swerves in their sense of humor to see, like, is something bad going to happen? Is this going to mm-hmm. throw the other person?
Right.
And then the other person just kind of goes with it.
Yeah.
Those are wonderful mm-hmm. experiences in real life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, one of the things that really stood out about this show is that it is so romantic. It is such a romantic show to me in a bunch of ways. And so I loved the fact that it had all the family stuff. I love how diverse this cast is. Mm-hmm. I love a bunch of the stuff that I have heard talked about a lot about this show. What I haven't heard enough about is, like, if you are a person who likes, like, zippy, great little mm-hmm.
banter.
You like great Efron.
Little, oh, my
any
gosh.
Efron, pick a
I
sister.
I just was in love with, again, this is like, and I talked about this with Trainwreck this summer too. Mm-hmm. This is one where it is about how much they like each other.
Yeah.
And that is the foundation of the romantic comedy, is how much they like each other from the beginning. And a little bit kind of not knowing what to do about that and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, Glenn is making skeptical faces,
okay. Believe it or not, I don't begrudge the romance. I don't begrudge any of these ideas, any of these topics, but when they're treated as topics, which is what this show seems interested in doing, the episode called Ladies and Gentlemen starts very smartly with mm-hmm. them walking, two dudes walking home from a bar by themselves, and
right.
then cutting to a woman walking home mm-hmm. from a bar by themselves. And that is all they needed to do. And then the entire rest of the episode goes back and underlines.
I actually
did
love this episode
and underlines.
Yeah.
And there's a part, you know, people talk about feminism. Yes, they do. But does somebody define what feminism is, and then somebody else, a woman, say, I'm surprised that you know that definition? Is that the way this dialogue proceeds? It just doesn't, it sounds like somebody studied Woody Allen and thought that they wanted to do that kind of thing. I'm going to compare how this show dealt with the threat of violence that hangs over women to another show that dealt with it. Another show which is doing something completely different, which is absolutely the opposite of this show in many ways. But they're dealing with the same topic, and I just want to mark the difference between that approach, underlined, 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 and this song called Sex with a Stranger from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. You've been tested for STDs. STDs. Tell me, please. STDs. Ran away to the 3-month window and got tested again. Just making sure. Most people don't know about the window. Hey, sexy stranger, let's go to my place. And please don't harvest my kidney. Now, the hook of that song is, please don't be a murderer. Please don't be a murderer. That's A. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Second, I also like the most people don't know about the window line.
Right.
I really like that line a lot. The best part of the song is the rap break, which is probably too hot for NPR, but it, trust me, it's great. What that is, I would argue, is light but sharp. And what that episode of Master of None is heavy but duller.
Okay.
And I would rather be filleted than bludgeoned.
I get that. I understand what you're saying, but I actually really liked, and I'm going to mention a scene that I suspect you didn't like. There is a scene in which she is talking about, his girlfriend is talking about what it is like when men come up to you and don't talk to you,
mm-hmm.
and what it is like mm-hmm. when they clearly are not acknowledging you because they're walking up and talking to the men at the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he and his friend kind of do the sort of like, nah, I don't know. If that's really what happened, don't you think he was probably just like, and then they leave the bar. She basically says, you are explaining to me why my experience does not exist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you've never been in this situation. And it's extremely frustrating
so
to me
right.
when you stand there and tell me that the sexist thing I'm telling you is happening isn't happening. I thrilled to mm-hmm. the fact that that was all overt, because people do have those conversations.
People absolutely have those conversations.
If you are in a good relationship, you do feel comfortable having those conversations, hopefully, where you can say, it's not, you don't have to sit there and be subtle. You don't have to come up and sit a way of kind of coming round about at that thing. You can say right to the person, we have a gender issue between the two of us, and now we're going to talk about it. That was thrilling to me.
And
that it
even
was
better, we're
going to
resolve it.
Right.
Which is the thing I think that is the most romantic thing, back
right.
to the rom-com thing about the relationship, is that there are so many moments where they fight really well and then recover really, really well.
Exactly.
And
it goes
that
back
is
to being funny
as,
right after that conversation.
Exactly. When she yells, I had a fight with mm-hmm. my boyfriend and I won. Mm-hmm. And that moment, I think that, because often in a rom-com, it is those moments, the like, we had a fight and now we're going to make out and whatever. Those things are the things that clang for me, mm-hmm. that don't feel right. I think those moments for them were particularly yeah. romantic. But I will say, Glenn, I actually hear you. That episode, I think that the front of that episode was a little heavy-handed, the sitting around the brunch table. And if I had one tiny complaint about the series, it would be that episode felt like, in which we really deal with gender, felt like the only one. And I would have liked to see more experiences mm-hmm. of more women on the show. I would have liked to see more Denise. I would have mm-hmm. liked to see.
I would have liked to see more Denise.
I would have liked
to
see all of Denise.
Yes. I mean, I want to see Denise.
Really like I'll watch her
she needs
spin
her own
all
show.
The day.
Yeah,
right, exactly. So if I have a complaint, it's more ladies having yeah. lives fleshed out.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
that episode for me was not enough.
I think any show benefits from something beyond the initial like rush of excitement and mm-hmm. praise about it. So I'm happy that we have like a variety of opinions, although mine is correct.
Yep.
Right.
I'm just kidding.
I'm in the tank for Linda.
So. I would love to hear what all of you have to say about Master of None. You can come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, a really interesting novel following more than one really interesting story, so don't go away.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Bleecker Street, presenting Trumbo. Who was Dalton Trumbo? To some, he was the Academy Award-winning writer who authored the novel Johnny Got His Gun and the screenplays for Roman Holiday and Spartacus. To others, he was a dangerous subversive who was blacklisted by Hollywood for his political beliefs. Starring Bryan Cranston as Dalton Trumbo, Louis C.K., Elle Fanning, John Goodman, Diane Lane, and Helen Mirren. Written by John McNamara, directed by Jay Roach. Trumbo, now playing in select cities, everywhere Thanksgiving.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Challenger Deep by Neil Schusterman is a novel about a teenage boy dealing with mental illness. It was it won the National Book Award just mm-hmm. this week for young person's fiction or whatever they call it. We thought that we would spend a little time with it. Barry, you helped us pick out this book to read. Can you talk a little bit about what you think is interesting about it?
I think it is. I mean, well, two things. One, it is a really, really interesting, a beautifully constructed way to talk about mental illness.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book.
So
there are basically two threads.
Both threads are the stories of Caden Bosch, which I think is an homage to Hieronymus. Mm-hmm. In one, he is this dream world in which he is the artist aboard a ship with a crazy parrot and a crazy captain, and mm-hmm. it is this odd dream world. And in the other, he is in an increasingly encroached upon world that is real with his parents and school, where you can see that what's happening in his head is beginning to encroach on that. And, you know, I could see that someone reading this book could have trouble with this structure, because it is really the first. I knew nothing about it when I picked it up.
At the beginning, it's very challenging.
It's very challenging.
I admit to having Googled this book to figure out what that was going on.
At the beginning, I stuck with it actually because it was so oddly constructed that I thought I had to get to a spot that I could hold on to. Mm-hmm. But what it ends up doing is the structure gives you the actual feeling of a person who is going through this in a way that is, I think, closer than any other unreliable narrator who may be struggling with mental illness that I have come across. So there is that. And then there is also this other thing about it that I think is really, which I didn't realize until I read the author's note at the back, which is that Neil Schusterman, the author, who's also responsible for the Unwind books, which are pretty fun as well for people that are interested in that kind of YA fiction. It's the book I realized at the end is a love letter to his son who struggled with this same schizoaffective disorder.
You sense that that's what's going on.
There is so much love suffused in this book, and the illustrations in the book, which I hate illustrations in a book unless I'm reading I don't want to see the extra blah blah blah.
Right, sure.
These really added to it for me, and they are done by his son. This very, very odd, you know, he's on a boat and then there's also the ship of mental illness and the sea of, you really do have this feeling of what it might be like if the world was beneath your feet was melting. And I found it just gorgeous.
I think it's disorienting in a very intentional and useful way. How about you, Glenn? What do you think?
My favorite thing about all of fiction is its ability to put us in the head of somebody else and have us see the world through their eyes. And I do feel, having finished this book, to understand schizoaffective disorder a little bit better. I feel like I've learned something.
And that's all you can ever get to,
that's
right?
All you can ever get
all
to.
All you can ever get to is a little bit better.
Right.
Like, and you cannot claim to understand it as a, like, I'm not an expert in it, but a little bit better,
So much work has been done, and again, you feel the love for this character, you feel like this great empathy, and my second favorite thing in all of fiction is the unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. I love being in somebody's head and having that person assert a version of reality to us. And then gradually, over the course of us, usually it works best is in short stories, but there's certainly many examples in novels, of other people assert a different reality as they kind of come up and bump up against us in this person's head. And that's how we see the world as it is. And those moments when he is saying a thing is happening and we get from around the edges, around the periphery, what's actually going on, that disconnect, that sharp disconnect is so bracing, and it can only happen in fiction. To this extent, to this kind of visceral extent. Mm-hmm. And I just really dug it. Now, I did think that the stuff on the ship, that's one of the threads here, that stuff felt more writerly, more symbolic, overtly symbolic. And of course,
it's overtly symbolic at times in a pretty kind of
schematic way.
Schematic way.
And that, you know, I understood what it was doing, I understood what it was going, but I didn't feel it, and I didn't buy it and love it to the extent that I loved the stuff about him in the hospital, him walking the streets, him negotiating these realities and trying to, and basically sinking into schizophrenia.
Yeah, and I think why some of the symbolism is mapped fairly directly, where something in that ship world has a pretty direct connection to something in the other world of kind of his day-to-day life, is one of the things that reflects that it's meant to be for younger readers. Mm-hmm. And I think when you are a younger reader, you haven't necessarily had as much time to experiment with a book as structurally ambitious as this. And so I think one of the reasons it is that way is to make it fairly,
useful.
Know, you don't want that symbolism to be so kind of opaque that you have to be a very experienced reader of abstract fiction to pick up those connections. So the fact that those connections are sometimes something that's almost like a pun.
Very on the nose.
It could potentially feel on the nose if you compare it. And again, we're back to this issue of subtlety or not.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. And we're back to this issue of whether subtlety is always a virtue. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think you can say about this book is there are times when subtlety is foregone in favor of making sure that this symbolism is going to be penetrable for a reader as young as, I would say, 11 or 12 at least.
Or as simple as myself.
What did you think of this book, Stephen?
I liked it. I had some of the same reactions that you guys did. I found, particularly early on, I was much more interested in real Caden than dream Caden.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Caden at sea. Mm-hmm. And I found, as is probably an appropriate reaction in a story such as this, that I found myself really clinging to the real, clinging to anything that felt like a truthful telling of what was going on. Mm-hmm. The way this book is structured, it's actually like 160 or so little pieces. Mm-hmm. They're not chapters, they're like chapterlets.
Vignettes.
Mm-hmm. Vignettes, sketches, and sometimes with actual sketches. Mm-hmm. It would gently toggle back and forth between, you know, like real as seen by real Caden and dream Caden. And I found myself like the beginning of each one, I would be like, where am I? I hope I'm on solid ground. And so I found myself frustrated early on that there was so much going on in the ship. and you feel like, all right, but this isn't what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And as those two halves are brought closer together as the book progresses, you really get a feel for why that stuff is there. And obviously mm-hmm. some of it is a little bit on the nose, but some of it also actually illuminates the reality that we're being told. And the reality that's going on makes the world on the ship more interesting. And it is a book that has these two streams blending together in ways that give the book real momentum and allow some of the hard points, some of the hard lessons, some of the moral of this story mm-hmm. to really kind of hit you right in the solar plexus. Mm-hmm. And I found myself going from being a little frustrated and a little detached from this book to really feeling it in the end. Mm-hmm. And I will say, the experience of reading the entire book and then reading the two-page author note.
Yeah.
The author note is a crucial part of this book mm-hmm. and the experience of this book and what stays with you about the book.
And aren't you glad that it was at the end? I actually, yes. thinking about that, I thought, because it was like a wonderful punch, because sometimes, and this is to your point, Linda, a YA novel will want to wrap things up in a way that it kind of gives us some hope there. It's slightly less complicated. Mm-hmm. But this really leaves open the possibility that, like many iterations of mental illness, that he may have another episode. It won't be today, but it may happen.
Sure.
And that, I thought, was really kind. And I loved, too. So, I mean, even this idea that, and in reading the author's note, you find that the author had actually accidentally taken the medication and so that was how he mm-hmm. was able to describe mm-hmm. the feeling of the mm-hmm. limbs like Jell-O. Because you hear this a lot, people complaining about, you know, well, why, if you can just take a pill, why wouldn't you? This really let me understand mm-hmm. the torture in some ways that is trying to climb out of this, that it isn't an easy path. It isn't a pill. It isn't, you know, a stuffy nose. It's like it is not easily solved.
Yeah, there's a lot about diagnosis and recovery that make clear what a non-linear process they are.
It's remission.
And given the provenance of this book, it makes sense that it has such a great sense of not only what this disease is doing to the kid, but is doing to everyone around him.
Yes. Oh,
and
yeah.
You get a real sense of this in these very heartbreaking scenes, mm-hmm. which are spare and not sentimental mm-hmm. and just real, just mm-hmm. overwhelmingly real.
Yeah. I want to not push back exactly, but I want to kind of challenge the way in which we're using the distinction between what is real and what is mm-hmm. and what is dream. It's not dream exactly, but it's somewhere in the realm of kind of hallucination or it is a manifestation of the illness.
It is inaccessible to the rest of the characters.
But one, exactly, because one of the things I really like about this book and one of the things I really like about the way the book is structured is that it makes clear that to him, all of this is real. And to him, all of this is happening. And one of the things that makes it so frightening and one of the things that I think makes the book so effective is that you understand that these things begin to, in certain places, blend together. And it's such an effective device because you begin to realize that for someone reading the book and for someone who's not dealing with an illness like this, you look at it and you do have that divide between this is what's really happening and this is what's in your head. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is, for the person having the experience, the relevance of that distinction is sometimes kind of limited mm-hmm. in terms of what they're feeling and what they're experiencing. And although I certainly have no experience with this kind of illness, they speak, as we've mentioned a couple times, they speak of this kid as suffering from what would be diagnosed as schizoaffective disorder. What I have a little bit of experience with is anxiety, right, which is really different. But one of the things that you learn about something like that over time is that you have to deal with it while recognizing that it's real to you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not, and I think anybody who's ever dealt with an anxious person mm-hmm. knows that it is not necessarily helpful to stand over them and say, but this is not
real. It's not real, right.
Because it doesn't help, right? But also because in a way it's not true. It's real to you. And mm-hmm. so I think the distinction between quote unquote real and not real mm-hmm. is a slippery one. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about the structure and the way it goes back and forth is that it underscores that. And that fragmented structure, the mm-hmm. fact that there's just a little bit of this and a little bit of that is one that I tend to gravitate toward, maybe because I have a short attention span. It reminded me of the Jenny Offel book.
Oh, Department of Speculation. Yes, right? which is one of my favorites.
Which has these little... you know, which has similar tiny vignettes that begin to weave together into something bigger.
Yeah,
so,
and I think it's important to note that if they ever make a movie of this thing, it won't capture what it, what the experience of reading this book.
I agree. I think that's a very good point.
What this book does with perception.
It is so empathetic, and yet it is not pitying in the slightest.
Yep.
It is simply very, very loving and empathetic. It. Once you've read that author's note, the book does feel so parental.
Mm-hmm.
It
feels
so. That was the moment I really burst into tears. Was the author moment.
And it it is hinted at throughout the book.
Yeah.
I mean, you read the dust jacket.
Yep.
And it's a picture of the author with his kid, and it's like the kid has provided these illustrations, and you see the illustrations, you're like, there is clearly a story here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that informs it even if you don't skip to the author's note when you're starting out.
Yeah. It's a lovely, lovely book. And I think, and it's another one that I think, yes, it's a YA novel,
but
there is plenty in here for any.
It is engrossing.
Reader of any adult age.
And it is, it is engrossing. It is hopeful.
Yeah.
And it is real.
Very moving. Very, very moving. We liked it. Good recommendation, Barry.
That was actually, I have to point out that it was actually Glenn's recommendation, although we had both read it.
Then never mind.
Those National Book Award people.
I don't want to be a credit hog.
Sometimes those National Book Award people know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. When we come back, we are going to move on to our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So we will be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Makespace. For people who dream about having a bigger closet and never want to visit a storage unit again, Makespace is like having an infinite closet. Here's how it works. Makespace picks up your stuff for free. They take it to storage for you, and they bring it back whenever you want. And now Makespace is giving all listeners $50 of free storage. Just schedule a pickup at makespace.com or download the Makespace app and enter promo code POP.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
We have talked on the show a number of times about our appreciation and love for the good people who made the film website The Dissolve. Full disclosure, I hired most of those people for the AV Club many years ago and remain dear friends with all of them.
We're in the tank for those guys.
We are in the tank for The Dissolve people in a big, big way. And like a lot of people, we were very sad when the site went away. Was delighted to see float by that the core group of Dissolve people, Scott Tobias, Keith Phipps, Tasha Robinson, Genevieve Kosky, have just started a podcast, a film podcast, of course, in collaboration with the wonderful film podcast Film Spotting, a perfect marriage of sensibilities. I know those folks all knew each other and respected each other for many years leading up to this, and seeing them collaborate on this podcast, it's called The Next Picture Show. The first episode is already out, and their mission is to view, quote, a new movie through the prism of an old movie, which is a very Dissolve-y approach. Like, they want to talk about old movies. They don't just want to review whatever the new stuff is. And so for the first episode, they look at Spotlight, which Audie recommended at the live show. Big, big Oscars-y movie. We will surely talk about more on this show. And they look at Spotlight, but then view it through the prism of All the President's Men.
Sure.
A similarly, you know, structured.
It's a very good idea. I love it.
And I love those people. They are wonderful, brilliant, encyclopedically knowledgeable people. The Next Picture Show with our pals from The Dissolve.
And we should also add that news also came out this week that Tasha is going to be a film critic at The Verge. So she also has a new writing gig. So.
Good.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
A few things. After months and months, I have finally finished the Helene Wecker book, The Gold. Golem. Not Gollum, Glenn. Don't say Gollum. It's Golem. The Golem and the Genie.
I love that book.
The reason it took me so long is not because of anything, but I wanted to live in this world for so long. I just slowed down chapter after chapter. I let more time pass. It is rich. It's mysterious. It's immersive. It's sad. It's beautiful. It's wise. It is the most textured and real book I have read in a long time. Considerably more than some of the National Book Award finalists I read recently. And it's got fantastic elements into it and is unapologetic about them, which I love. You know, literary writers of literary fiction tend to, if they include something, a ghost or something, they keep it at arm's length and it's, well, it's a symbol. First and foremost, it's a symbol. What?
Right. Or it's Marquez.
Right. This just goes into it, that steers into the skid, and it's so much richer and smarter and wonderful for it. So I can't recommend that book enough. This last weekend, I got a chance to appear on the podcast, Jordan, Jesse, Go.
You sure did.
It is my favorite podcast. I'm a fan. And anytime I'm on it, this is my second time on it, it always feels like I'm the girl in the Aha video being kind of ripped from reality into by a tiny-nosed, ferret-faced Norwegian and brought into a world of race car danger and pipe wrenches. It's just weird to be on the show because I
it's a great episode. It's called Erotic Martial Arts.
It's called Erotic Martial Arts.
That's
also
the episode of Jordan Jesse Go.
It was great. Lastly, I've been traveling, and there's a lot of other things going on in my life right now, so I don't have much time when I get out of the day job, but Star Wars Battlefront just came out for the PS4, as did Fallout 4. Both of these two huge immersive things that I'm not going to chance to get to for a long time.
But for a while. I
will, but they're making me happy just having them.
Thank you very much. Speaking of happy just to have them, Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, first, I'm going to say I'm going to make Glenn happy by saying she has another book, a follow-up, coming out in a couple of months.
Awesome.
So I'm happy to add some happy to your happy. Mm-hmm. And then this is a sort of an odd moment to recommend this series, actually. But the other binge watching I've been doing is of a show called W1A, which is the BBC's follow-up to 2012. Which was a spoof of the Olympics, where Hugh Bonneville, who plays Lord Grantham on Downton, mm-hmm. Who's a lovely Brit, is sort of this fictional guy. I had never watched 2012, and so he is the head of deliverance, I guess, for the Olympic, which was just a spoof of how the Olympics went in London. I did not watch it. It did not get great reviews. But I was told that I need to watch the spin-off in which he becomes the head of values at the BBC. So this is now a spoof of a news organization.
A public media organization, even.
Exactly. It was so enjoyable. Now, I do not know. Listeners, I do not know if you will enjoy this as much as I did. It is some real inside baseball about the news, about public media. It is so funny. Mm-hmm. And I think all three of you would really appreciate this show. And I hope all billion of you. That might be some hopeful numbers.
It's got a weird name. Yeah. Give it to me again.
W1A, which is the address of the British Broadcasting House. There's some amazing physical comedy, too, guys, about the place itself, which being in this building that we're in right now, historic Studio 44, we will all appreciate. You must delve.
Wonderful.
Nice.
Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman, W1A. Where can we watch that?
On Netflix.
On Netflix. All right. Thank you very much. As you know, if you listen to the show, last week you received our live show, partly because a bunch of us were on vacation. Stephen had pneumonia.
I was on vacation with pneumonia.
Pneumonia vacation.
Vacation from health.
Right. Our lovely producer, Jessica_Reedy, also had a vacation. And I had a vacation, which I was in New York. There's like the vacation. There's the staycation. Mm. I invented what I'm calling the haycation, which is the H-E-Y, hey, where your entire vacation is saying to people, hey, I'm going to be in town. So can we get drinks or coffee or something like that? It's just a haycation, right? The entire point of this trip, I spent a week in New York, was to have a series of talks with people who I think are wonderful, who either I talk to them about work or I talk to them about my life or I just love them generally or what have you. During this haycation, however, I also attended three live podcast tapings, because that's how I do when I'm in New York. I attended a taping of NPR's own Ask Me Another, mm-hmm. which was a lot of fun. One of the folks working on producing that show, of course, is our beloved Mike Katzef, so I got to see him and hang out. I attended a taping of The Sporkful, which is Dan Pashman's food podcast, in which he had his long-awaited smackdown with the great John Hodgman over whether a hot dog is a sandwich. Spoiler alert, a hot dog is not a sandwich.
No, of course not. It
is not a sandwich.
Stupid.
That debate was lengthy, vigorous, very satisfying. It was a lot of fun to go to. And then I also attended a taping of Song Exploder, mm-hmm. which is through Radiotopia, a podcast where they break down songs. In this case, it was Brill Bruisers by the New Pornographers.
Perfect song.
Carl Newman was there talking about that song and how they wrote it and all that stuff. So that was great fun. And I ran into Jessica Reedy at that podcast taping because she was also in New York. And I walked in with Mike Katzef and ran into Jessica Reedy. So what could be better than that?
Man, nobody ran into me while I was hacking up a lung.
Yeah, I would have run into you, I think. So in addition to that, I saw many, many people who know who they are, who I spent wonderful time with, who I'm extraordinarily fond of, and it was great fun, and thanks to everybody that I saw, but thanks especially to those three podcasts. I love going and watching other people tape their shows and seeing what they're doing, and so super exciting. It was great. I feel really happy to be back, but I'm also really happy that I had a week off. So excellent times in New York with cool peeps and podcast tapings is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman. That's B-H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katzef, at Mike Katzef, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our In and Out music, which you are tapping your merry foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Be honest, are you a music nerd or a fledgling music nerd who wants to know more about what's out there? The All Songs Considered podcast from NPR Music is here to help. All Songs Considered is a music discussion and discovery podcast from NPR. Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best new and upcoming music, including the Carrie Brownstein We Never Knew and a chat with Nico Case. Find lots of songs you'll fall in love with on All Songs Considered every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.